Welcome to Galaxy Brains, the weekly podcast from Galaxy Research. You want back here to rip a rap in a black shirt. Bip and bap, let the snare hit with reverb. Tit for tat, all you haters hit the reverse. Ain't nobody say that my game isn't hot, and you're rapping to be famous, but you're lame, so just stop. So dirty when I flow, someone gave me a mop. You could see me rolling deep with the Jameson lop, and I'm stopping up the track, but nobody flow better. Throw the kid a bone because he a go-getter. Yeah, I got some drip, but nobody flow wetter. Sure, you play the game, but your jacket no letter. I pack it and transact because the game is not ready. Yo, I only follow blocks if the chain is so heavy. I only follow clocks if the unit is Satoshi. I'm never gonna stop till the mic's exploding. As always, I'm your host, Alex Thorne, head of firm-wide research at Galaxy. Thank you for listening to Galaxy Brains. We have a great show for you today. As I said, Jameson Lopp, CTO and co-founder of Casa, is our guest. We're going to talk privacy, Bitcoin, Bitcoin culture, technology, a bunch of interesting stuff. And we'll check in with our good friend Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading, as always, to talk markets and macro. Before we get to all of that, I need to remind you, please refer to the link to the disclaimer in the podcast notes, and note that none of the information in this podcast constitutes investment advice or an offer, recommendation, or solicitation by Galaxy Digital or any of its affiliates to buy or sell any securities. What up, Phineas? You're back. We're back. We're still here.
It's the new year, and a lot of great stories to tell.
It's been pretty exciting.
Galaxy Brains 2024. I'm excited about it.
Yeah. And, markets have been wild. The ETFs are in play now. We got whole new market mechanics and dynamics at play. Lots of heavy trading between 3 and 4 p.m. New York time now, when all the ETFs fix and do their trading. So it's getting exciting. And also, it's getting cold out here. I mean, am I getting weak? Are we all getting weak? You get one cold snap in the U.S. and everyone loses it. I thought, isn't it winter?
No, you just forget every year how bad it is every year at this time in New York. It's windy, it's cold.
Yeah.
And then everybody, you know, gets depressed for a few months, and then we get better and we forget. And we're like, oh, New York's great again.
Yeah, I'm in New York right now recording, but if you listen to this on Thursday or Friday, I'll be in Nashville at Bitcoin Park for the mining summit there, which will be a lot of fun. But they were absolutely decimated by the cold. The Midwest in general, Nashville, as I say this, is 0 degrees Fahrenheit.
Crazy.
Full ground stop at the airport and stuff. It's like, I guess, you know, you just like you're not prepared for it if you're like in the South, you know. They don't have like, it's not like, you know, I'm from Massachusetts originally, you're a Vermonter, like we got plenty of snow plows. Yeah. People are used to that thing.
That's exciting though. Bitcoin Park, you've been, you went like six, four.
I've gone plenty of times, and... yeah, big fan. Yeah, it's the like sort of Bitcoin third place in Nashville. It's also, Nashville will host Bitcoin 2024, Bitcoin Magazine's conference this year now. I guess it's 2024. And so Bitcoin Park, real nexus, you know, it's like, in some ways it's the pub key of Nashville, or Bitcoin Park of New York. So
yeah, absolutely.
These things are sprouting up all over the world. The movement is real.
That's cool.
Let's hop right into it with our friend Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading. Let's go now to our friend Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading. As always, Bimnet, welcome to Galaxy Brains.
Thanks for having me.
It's been an exciting week. When we recorded last week, we recorded right after the Bitcoin ETFs were approved.
Yep.
But now we're recording on Wednesday, and they've traded for 3 full trading days, Thursday, Friday, Tuesday. Monday was a holiday in the United States, so markets were closed. Let's get right to it. I mean, what are your takes so far on the ETF complex?
I think the total flows into the product are anemic at this point. I think the figures are, you know, as of yesterday, there was $800 million of net inflows into the ETFs. Of which, you know, Grayscale had 1.8 yards that were outflows. And I think a lot of the inflows, of the net inflows, were a function of people just exchanging Bitcoin.
Or some other exposure.
Or some other Bitcoin-related exposure into the ETF. And so, high level, I think the net amount of new money that entered the space because of the ETF is a lot smaller than people think. Mm-hmm. You know, I worry, you know, from the standpoint that there aren't too many near-term catalysts for Bitcoin. You know, the halving is a long ways away.
3 months or so,
You know, and the ETH ETF is probably way, way longer away. And, you know, macro conditions were about as good as they could have possibly been for the ETF launch. You know, bond yields were at their dead lows. Stocks were at, you know, the dead highs. And that's starting to turn a little bit now. And so I see a market that has spent the last year, mainly the last 6 months, bidding up Bitcoin and Bitcoin-related exposure in anticipation of this ETF. bringing in new inflows, and we aren't really getting those inflows. And I see an asset right now that's basically unchanged on the year. We started the year like basically at this exact same level. And I think there are going to be a lot of folks that, you know, have bought in the run like higher than here, basically, that are going to be underwater. And a lot of folks that are probably going to be less enthusiastic about Bitcoin because it's not going to have the same vol profile right now. You've taken out a lot of the, you know, speculative positioning. There's no near-term catalyst, right? Like, I don't see a scenario where I'm FOMO chasing Bitcoin at the dead highs.
Yeah.
Whereas you got paid to do that for the last 6 months. You bought the highs at any point in the last 6 months.
And then it went higher.
And then it went higher eventually. You might have been in some short-term pain, but that is not the case anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way I think about Grayscale is at the start of this, you know, they were sitting around $29 billion in assets. And the ETF approval basically unlocked $29 billion of supply. Now, a lot of that is hedged, et cetera. But at its core, this was the largest supply event of Q1. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a demand event. Not if you're thinking about it from a near-term perspective.
Right.
But there's a ton of supply that just got unlocked. And so from a demand-supply perspective, you know, it looks imbalanced to me still here with Grayscale having $25-plus billion in AUM at current levels.
Yep, yep.
And I think this is a market that has a relatively short attention span. And while Bitcoin was a hot narrative, you know, around the ETF launch, that's not to say that, you know, it's going to be on people's minds or the forefront of their you know, trading next week.
Yeah.
Right? You still have, you know, these huge other, like, macro things going on. Like, gilts moved, like, 20 basis points today. You know, stocks are off. Like, there's a lot of exciting stuff happening. And so it's going to be tough for Bitcoin to hold attention. But to those of us that are in crypto native world, like, you know, I think it might mean you see a little bit more focus on alts, or, you know, other parts of the crypto ecosystem, and, you know, other ways to kind of engage and make money. But in terms of, like, Bitcoin itself, I'm not that constructive here. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of mixed views out there. But, you know, I've been basically bullish for since last year, the start of last year.
Right.
Let alone, like,
right.
you know, and right now I'm cautious at best.
Yep, I think that's fair.
If not outright bearish.
I think that's fair in the near term. I think
but big picture, yeah.
For sure. I mean, you remain a long-term Bitcoin bull. I just to clarify for anyone who I don't think anyone who listens to this show would question that.
Yeah.
But I agree, and I've been saying too that I think, you know, months 3 to 6, 3 to 12 matter a lot more for the ETF complex than months 1 to 3. Because as we've repeatedly hammered home, the primary net new market for these products is the advisors and wealth management channel.
Correct.
And as far as I can tell, none of them are turning it on yet. Many of them need to wait for a month or more just for track record to add one to their platform. So I want to also be cautious to people reading too much into early AUM and volume numbers, because again, pretty much the only people that can trade this right now is retail investors. And some have disagreed with me on this. Fred Krueger disagrees with me on this statement, but that retail's had access to this for years, whether through Coinbase and River and Cash App, or through the trust before they converted, or through equities that are linked to Bitcoin, right? Like, they've had plenty of ways. And the real platforms that don't are the bank and broker-dealer affiliated advisors, and they're not here yet. So, yeah. So in the absence of that net new demand, which I still view as net new, we've just got sort of like retail out here so far, right? And a lot of, inorganic flow from these issuers as well.
No, I completely agree with that. And I think the other thing to note is that, you know, this is a marginable security now. And you can get, you know, leverage on Bitcoin a lot easier if you're retail.
Through the ETFs.
Through the ETF, right? And so, same way, you know, you could buy other stocks on leverage and margin, you know, it's going to really allow people to kind of lever up if they want to,
right,
in a relatively, you know, cheap way. You're going to pay like SOFR plus like
so that
a
can
little
be constructive.
Bit. That is going to be constructive, you know, over the long run. But just right here, right now, it you know, it it's tough to think that you're going to just break out to new highs in the next, like, 2 months.
Totally.
You know, local highs.
All right, you mentioned macro environment has shifted a little bit. I saw there was some Fed speak. Previously, Dovish was a Waller in particular.
Waller in particular yesterday, you know, was expected to be a little bit more dovish than usual on the dovish side of things. However, he came out with a message that basically said that rate cuts need to be more gradual, and there's no need to be as aggressive as they have been in the past,
right?
Because of the balance dynamics in terms of growth and the employment picture. Like, if employment was collapsing and falling off a cliff while inflation was coming down this aggressively, then you would need to cut. But this is a historically tight labor market, and growth is still okay. And you've got, you know, a fiscal impulse that's still fairly robust. And, you know, we're talking about more tax cuts now and stuff. And so, you know, I think what he reiterated was that the cut pricing in the market was a little too aggressive. And that, you know, they're also, he didn't quite go into this, but we've had a pretty dramatic easing in financial conditions over the past, you know, 2-3 months with stocks ripping to fresh highs and bond yields collapse, mortgage rates coming down. And so there is some kind of like inflationary effect to that at some point. And overall, the economy is still in a super healthy spot. And so, you know, I think the Fed is trying to take a bit more of a measured approach to the rate cut path and policy. And it's not only been domestic, but you had like six or seven different Fed speakers come out, ECB speakers come out last night that also reiterated similar messaging.
Yeah.
And you had a surprise in UK data as well to the upside. And God forbid, like, oil goes higher.
Right.
Right. Like, we
with the various straits and channels and canals at risk.
We live in a post-pandemic world, right, that with tons of geopolitical risk, like, everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, to go back to, you know, zero interest rates or negative interest rates in the case of Europe is a very tough, you know, thing to swallow. And it honestly, I don't think it's feasible in the world we live in right now. And so I think what basically happened is people's expectations of where terminal rates are going to be domestically and abroad have started to come up. And we've seen U.S. fixed income sell off, you know, to the tune of about 20 basis points, depending on what part of the curve you look at.
Yep.
And you've had similar moves in Europe, in the ECB curve and in the UK curve as well. And so, yeah, I just think that, you know, the world was priced to perfection, and now it's starting to acknowledge the two-sided risks
so
to inflation.
Markets are still pricing some cuts this year.
A tremendous amount.
Right. I mean, was I wrong? I may have looked at this panel wrong, but I mean, 160 basis points.
It's crazy. 150, give or take, whatever. Yeah,
That still seems a lot. So did they?
Especially depending on the pace, though. If they're going 50 at a time, that's three. Right. But if they're going 25 and 50, like, that's what,
right.
You know.
So those, I don't know how to say this as a rates person, they repriced higher, or the cuts reduced.
They
came in a little bit reduced from where they, so they had been really aggressive, even more than that. Now we're back a little, but still forecasting further easing this year.
Correct.
The market.
Correct. And that's just largely based on the fact that inflation has moved much closer to target. Yeah. It's not at target, but if your mandate is full employment and inflation, now,
because just like they don't want to miss, like, have inflation missed or beat to the upside, they don't want to miss to the downside and end up with deflation.
Yeah.
So this is part of the soft landing, like,
trying to
decelerate the rates or reduce them slowly right into their 2% narrative.
Yes.
If they can.
But at the same time, it's like, you know, we've had this discussion before. It's like absolute prices are up like 20%+.
So that's those aren't coming back.
That's just not coming back.
Yeah.
And they're still focused on this, you know, rate of growth or rate of change of prices.
Right.
And so that's kind of a debate. But overall, you know, the kind of things I'm monitoring are, like, you know, savings balances are starting to come off. Like, the excess balances from, you know, the pandemic have started to get eaten into. You've seen a pickup in, you know, credit card default rates and stuff. And, and a lot of the soft data indicators.
I saw somebody saying that like online, I don't want to say the platforms, but, you know, the big online ad sellers, right? So the big tech companies, the search engine giants that do this, are laying off huge swaths of their ad teams, and that this has also historically been a leading indicator of, like, a downturn in the economy. Ad spending.
Ad spending. Yeah, there's lots of things like that that are saying you're headed towards a slowdown. And so basically the Fed's being like, you know, rates are probably too restrictive in the context of, like, what we're seeing in the future, like, on a forward
this
indicator basis.
Slowdown, yes.
Yes. And yeah. And it's like, I agree with them. Like, the rates are probably too high by, like, 100, 150 basis points. But at the same time, like...
Well, there's no sense in overcutting too soon. Yeah. You can always cut more. That's what's great about having brought it up this high. They
exactly.
Have
you
can
cut
more
100
tools
basis points tomorrow.
If they need to.
If they need to.
So, like, start a little lower and slower.
It's like you have... You don't have, like, the world blowing up.
Right.
Like, and... yeah. And you know it's also... I mean, the big thing, though, is... Like, they're gonna, the fiscal issues are gonna hit them at some point. The math is just gonna catch up with it. That's really when I think, you know, Bitcoin gets
going. This is one of the most positive things to come out of the high rate environment in my mind is the finally some, some true awareness, renewed, much more serious discussion, not just from like gold, you know, gold bugs and long term, doomers.
Everyday people.
Yeah, about the cost of the national debt and the fiscal spending on this. And high rates, of course, increase the service costs of the debt. And so it's made people really realize, like, wait a second, we're going to be spending 15, 20, 30, 50% under some future of our entire budget just servicing the debt, right? And it's like you pay your mortgage every month and you don't even take anything off the principal.
Yeah. I mean, if our only voters were like between the ages of like, 15, and like 30.
Yeah.
Right? Like the world would look totally different.
Yeah.
And like the care about the fiscal stuff, like you couldn't kick the can down the road because you're kicking it to these people.
To yourself.
And that's like why. I mean, I'm just like, as a, you know, I'm not young anymore. I'm almost 30. But like, I'm like thinking about like 15 years from now, 30 years from now, the fiscal picture is just abhorrent. And I think at some point, like, the market is going to force the government's hand with this stuff. And Bitcoin is
one of those barometers,
because ultimately it comes down to, like, is the dollar the reserve currency? Is there another alternative to it? Like, will, like, markets really push on that? Like, if people were like, I'm not buying 30-year debt anymore. Like, the central bank's going to have to buy it all. Like, I'm not touching it because they're not going to pay it. Then that'd be like a moment of reckoning, and that's when, you know, you'd expect Bitcoin to go up. And also, they're gonna start expanding the balance sheet pretty soon with the end of QT and the eventual resumption of QE, and that's gonna be a pretty huge upside catalyst for Bitcoin. But it's just gonna take time.
Yeah, so no change in that. Still looks bad, the long term fiscal and debt servicing picture. Constructive there. That's part of Bitcoin's long term value proposition.
If the market was only focused on trading that, Bitcoin would be at the moon.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know what value it would have.
Yep.
Like, anyway.
Bim Netabibi from Galaxy Trading, my friend, as always, thank you for coming on Galaxy Brains.
Thank you.
Let's go now to our guest, Jameson Lopp, CTO of Casa. Jameson, thank you so much for coming on Galaxy Brains.
Great to be here.
I've been following your work for quite some time. I know our audience has as well. I've got some interesting topics that I want to talk with Jameson about. But before we do that, I would love if Jameson, if you could share some of your background, and I'll just prime this. You're the co-founder and CTO of Casa, a Bitcoin collaborative custody, a self-custody company. But you've been working in Bitcoin for a long time. I'd love if you could introduce yourself and tell our audience a little bit about your background in the space.
Yeah, so I got interested in Bitcoin in 2012, spent my first year just meandering around trying to understand it better, launched a fork of Bitcoin Core in 2014, and that was not a network fork, just a software fork where I was adding a bunch of analytics and instrumentation so that we could better understand what was going on inside of Bitcoin Node. And that project was called Satoshi, and I consider that a success because it was referred to by a number of developers over the years when making arguments about potential changes to the protocol. I was then lucky enough to go full-time in 2015, and I spent the next 3 years working on infrastructure at BitGo, where I was basically responsible for all of the indexing, making sure that our databases were up to date with, you know, the latest transactions and balances for wallets of our clients, managing our send queues, and in general, just trying to keep a lot of the operational back end up and running smoothly. It was then a very small pivot for me in 2018 to go to Casa, where we were using similar aspects of the protocols, specifically multi-signature functionality, so that you could have a wallet where you have multiple keys that are distributed around to give you much higher levels of robustness and security. BitGo was really doing that for enterprises, helping exchanges and payment processors secure their wallets. And Casa really focuses on helping individuals achieve really high levels of security. So really what Casa does is we're like a concierge security consultation service where, you know, we offer a very user-friendly mobile app that pairs with various hardware devices that keep your keys offline, secure, distributed in multiple locations. And we also offer a really high level of customer service to help people, you know, whenever anything goes wrong, if they're having problems with the technology, or just to advise them on making decisions of trade-offs between convenience and security and, you know, their own self-custody setup. So, you know, Casa has been going strong for, I guess, almost 6 years now. And so far, so good. We've actually expanded and rolled out support for Ethereum and some of the top stable coins recently as a result of demand from our clients who are, you know, holding assets in a number of different protocols.
Yeah, Casa is a great, great product. I've used it for a while, so I can say that. Talk to me, Jameson, about multisig in general. This is and maybe the Ethereum point is an interesting one to segue into as well, because multisig is native on Bitcoin, but not on Ethereum. But before we get into that, what is I don't want to say the benefit. I think that's pretty clear what the benefit of, but maybe you could explain what multisig is and why it's so revolutionary when it comes to digital assets.
I kind of describe a few different tiers of ownership of crypto assets. Tier zero is you're a no coiner. You don't have any crypto assets. That's the vast majority of the world today. Tier one is you own IOUs for these assets. And what I mean there is you've gone to an exchange or a broker and you've hooked it up to your bank account, otherwise funded your account, and you've purchased these assets. However, the actual keys to those assets are held by the third-party custodian. So at any point in time, a number of things could go wrong and you could be unable to access those assets. Next tier is taking self-custody. And the vast majority of people who take self-custody and they withdraw those assets from the exchange, they generally put them into a single signature wallet. If you put that into what's called a hot wallet, where the actual key is on your computer or your phone or whatever, you know, that's better than having the key with a third party, but it's not great because the key is still potentially exposed to hackers, malicious software, so on. The next step beyond that is putting those keys on a dedicated hardware device, Trezor, Ledger, Cold Card. There's quite a few out there. And this gives you a really high level of security, you know, prevents pretty much all hacker-based attacks of actually just stealing your keys outright. And this is good for most people. However, there's still single points of failure. And specifically, this is because you have one key that controls everything. So if that key gets lost, even if it doesn't get hacked or stolen, but that key gets lost, you're effectively locked out of your money. So the final tier of self-custody is one in which you eliminate single points of failure. In which you can be human, you can make mistakes, you can have things go wrong and them not be catastrophic. And this is where multisig really shines, because it allows you to create architectures that I would argue can far exceed that of the strongest bank vault or even of something like Fort Knox. You know, even Fort Knox is a single point of failure. It theoretically could get destroyed somehow. So when you are able to diversify your key material into different geographic locations into storage by different hardware manufacturers with different supply chains and different software and different firmware. Really what this allows you to do is you're able to leverage the magic of something we call additive security, which is basically a strength through diversity, so that you know that there can always be a potential failure or things that can go wrong or weaknesses in any particular key storage solution. But if your keys are all in different solutions, then you know that anything that goes wrong with one of them is highly unlikely to go wrong with the other ones. And that's how you basically weather a loss situation, is that if a loss occurs, you're only going to lose, you know, one of your three or five keys or whatever, and that's fine. You just go get a new device and generate a new key and carry on. And really, this is what Casa is trying to make much easier for people to enter into these types of architectures and to reason about them and think about the trade-offs, because they have, you know, export service to go along with it.
That's a great explanation, Jameson. I think the diversification, even geographically or with multiple types of parties, right? You have it on your phone or in multiple hardware wallets, is a truly powerful innovation. So when you add, what's so interesting is that this is basically composable natively on Bitcoin, right? This is something that you can, you're not, you know, reinventing Bitcoin core technology to do this, right? You're simply using it.
Yeah, Bitcoin has been a part, it's had this multi-signature part of the protocol since, I want to say 2013, 2014. There was an early version of multi-sig that was not very good, and thankfully almost nobody used it. But then when pay-to-script hash came out, I think late 2013, early 2014, BitGo was one of the first multi-sig wallet providers to take advantage of that. And since then, quite a few wallet providers have come out that have supported multi-sig. However, you know, the vast majority of wallets out there are free, like use at your own risk type of things. So it's very easy for someone to get in over their head and you know, set up their multi-sig in a way that's not great. It could still have single points of failure.
Yeah, there was one, I remember, was it BitPay's wallet Copay that had some early multi-sig functionality maybe in 16, 17, but it suffered effectively a supply chain, open source software supply chain bug, right? There was like a compromised library under there that it was used to, so, you know, there's a history of these things being dangerous. That's why I think but now I think it's much more mature. You guys, Unchained Capital, a variety of other providers are making use of it.
Yeah, and I think that's a story of why diversity is important. I think the problem there with Copay is that all of the keys were being stored in the same software. And so, you know, you have a bug in that software, and if it's all the same, then every key is exposed to that same vulnerability.
Even if Casa disappears, using my keys and the derivation path information and stuff, I can then reconstitute. So to your point about, you know, it's not all actually in the Casa app in that sense.
Correct. This is actually an often overlooked point. Like when we say at Casa that we are helping people eliminate single points of failure, that includes Casa itself. We want to make sure that even if Casa blows up or ceases to exist for any reason, or even if Casa turned malicious for some reason, you know, be as paranoid as you want, you know, nation state actor, whatever, that it should not be possible for Casa clients to lose money or to get locked out of their funds as a result of Casa, the company, failing. And so this is actually one of the first things that happens when you finish initializing a multi-signature wallet at Casa, is that we give you all the information and instructions that you need to be able to recreate that wallet and access those funds without using any Casa software or infrastructure.
Yeah, it's very powerful. All right, let's move on. I have some other stuff I want to ask you about, Jameson. I love the multi-sig story. I think it's one of the most interesting things about Bitcoin in general, that frankly is one of the core use cases of it. I also think similarly about proof of reserves or, you know, cryptographic attestations of ownership, I should say, even more broadly, also being a core use for Bitcoin. But I want to get into some of what I first learned about your content, you, Jameson, was all the content that you produce. You produce a lot of content, you have for years. You know, I've been sending people to lop.net/bitcoin.html for a long time. You now have bitcoin.page that goes there. I don't know how to ask this. What was the motivation for aggregating all that information? It's a great website that has a whole host of information on almost everything you can think of about Bitcoin. How much work is it? What got you started doing that? Was it a project for yourself that then became useful to others? Like, how did you get doing that?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much all of my projects are self-serving. In particular, the educational resources that I maintain that I think have, at this point, over 2,000 different links in them, started off just as a list of bookmarks in my browser. And really what happened over time is I kept realizing I would get the same questions repeated over and over again, and I would have to go find the answers and the resources. And so it was very redundant. And it was, I guess, back in 2015 or 2016, I was like, I need to just take this list of bookmarks and I need to put them on a website, and then I can just paste the link to the website and say, here, you know, find it for yourself. And so, you know, that started off with maybe 100 links. And over the years, it has expanded into like 40 different pages. And like I said, thousands of different links as the ecosystem has grown and has, you know, become much more diversified and, you know, has resources that are, you know, much more specialized in what they're trying to do. So I maintain that on a almost daily basis. You know, whenever I come across a new resource that I think is good, I'll add it in. I also have to do regular pruning as various websites go offline and are no longer supported because, you know, I don't want a ton of dead links on there. But it mostly runs itself pretty smoothly these days. And I even have been posting metrics about it for my annual report recently, kind of showing that the interest and number of visitors going to my website has been pretty flat during the bear market as expected. I think based upon previous activities, once you see the number of visitors to my website really spiking, that usually signals that we're near the end of the bull market because retail is FOMOing in.
I love that. And you've also written a lot yourself. I'm just browsing your page now on lop.net. And I mean, you've written about a whole bunch of, I'm going to say, you know, semi-esoteric Bitcoin topics, you know, what economically unspendable UTXOs are, just looking at some of your recent ones. You've written about who or who may not be Satoshi Nakamoto. One of my favorite ones you did was a whole series on demonstrating and investigating the integrity of metal seed backup plates, where you were blowtorching some of them and putting others in acid and showing how they held up. And I think one of the most important ones that you've done for years is the performance tests on Bitcoin node software, but also on Ethereum software. I think that was one of the most interesting ones you did. How do you find the time to do these tests in particular?
I mean, this is what I do for fun, right? Like the sort of research stuff is, it's a hobby of mine that I've done for many years. It all started off with my Satoshi project almost 10 years ago now. And Satoshi started because I started running a Bitcoin node, but I was like, okay, what is it doing? You know, I want to understand it better. And pretty much all of these other things are, you know, unanswered questions that I wanted to understand better. As I'm investigating them, I write down my process of what I'm doing. And my goal here is that even though I do have a number of open source projects, like I'm not a full-time open source developer, but I do consider most of what I spend my time doing with research to be in the sort of open source ethos. So I want to make all of this knowledge open and accessible so that hopefully it will save a lot of other people a lot of time and effort, and perhaps they can even build upon that further.
Yeah, it's been very useful to me over the years. Let's talk a little bit about privacy, Jameson, because you're one of the most articulate and consistent advocates for operational security, OPSEC, as we say, both generally, but also in particular as it relates to Bitcoin. There was a story, I think, in the New York Times about an incident that you suffered. I don't know if you're comfortable retelling that story briefly to our audience, but I think it would provide good color for the rest of this conversation.
Yeah, I've written extensively about it. So I have three or four long essays where I described everything that happened and really what I did as a reaction to it. But the short version is that in 2017, as a result of my sort of rise in prominence on Bitcoin Twitter, I amassed a large enough audience that eventually some malicious people decided that they would try to extort me. And so they called my local law enforcement and pretended to be me and claimed I had killed people and had hostages and had bombs and really used all of the trigger words that are necessary to get a lethal level of force directed at me. And they were able to do this because it was very easy to find my house. It was public information. I owned a house that address was in numerous different databases that anybody who spent a little time probably Googling or $20 doing a sort of people lookup report could find that address. So thankfully, the incident ended without anyone getting hurt, and a number of swatting incidents do not end peacefully, and innocent victims end up getting harmed by police. But really what I took away from all of that was that the only way I could really defend myself against those type of attacks was to ensure that I wasn't creating a target for someone to point this force at in the first place. So I spent the next year learning a lot about privacy, really extreme privacy. And I sold off all of the assets that I had that were registered in my name. And I moved and I set up new house and vehicles and all of those publicly registered assets under corporations that were anonymously owned by other entities, and then just went to further lengths to ensure that my name and my physical address were never put into any databases, public or private. And that basically involved, creating other mailbox addresses and sort of proxies in a number of different facets of my life. Once I was confident that shield was set up, I paid private investigators to try to break through it and find me. That's when I embarked upon my quest to go after the person who swatted me. I put out a $100,000 bounty on them, and the tips started rolling in. And then that turned into kind of a multi-year investigation in conjunction with the FBI, who eventually found him. And we did manage to get him into court, and he pled guilty, and hopefully he's turning his life around. But it ended up being a teenage kid, so I kind of got a slap on the wrist, and I kind of felt sorry for him. He wasn't in a great situation, and he fell in with the wrong crowd. And a number of hacker and security types screwed up when they were teenagers. I made mistakes when I was a teenager too. So I hope that, it's a learning lesson for him, and that he'll be able to use his skills for good rather than evil in the future.
Well, it sounds like it was a learning lesson for you. So one of the things that I've been working on, actually, Jameson has a great post from February of last year, how to protect your home network with a gigabit VPN, which I've been working on. And it's a little bit technical, but again, your digital life, your digital traffic, whether you literally leaking your IP address, which can be quite easily tied to your identity, is also a big part of this. I wanted to ask Jameson, you had a real on the ground reason why privacy is so important. And But what are the more sort of societal impacts in your mind about losing your privacy, either to the government or to third parties? Why does privacy matter to the everyday person?
Well, the problem is that you don't know what might be used against you in the future. And so, you know, in the communication age, information travels instantly and quickly. And once information gets out there, you can't take it back. So much like how I had many aspects of my life that were public back then, I wasn't dreaming of the fact that someone might send a SWAT team to my house because I would become a prominent figure in a niche, you know, Twitter community. You never know what's going to happen. And one of the examples that I like, I mean, there's a lot of examples out there, but one of the downsides to the nature of the internet is that you can go from being a nobody to being a somebody instantly, just if you do or say the wrong thing. You know, we all know what it means to go viral, but a lot of people haven't experienced that. And I think most people won't experience that. But if you are an active internet user, especially if you're on social media or if you're, you know, creating content, if you're speaking your mind, then it's always possible that something you do or say kind of triggers a hive mind and that you end up with the ire of millions of people directed at you overnight. And that is when you will wish that you had strong privacy put in place. So, you know, some good examples of that. There was, I think her name was Justine Sacco. For example, she was a marketing person and she got on a flight, I think, to go from America to Africa where she had family. And she made some sort of off-color joke about hoping she didn't get AIDS while she was in Africa. And she was someone who had like 100 followers on Twitter, but for whatever reason, luck was not with her on that day. And her tweet went viral, had millions of people talking about it. And people actually showed up at the airport when she landed. So, you know, she went to sleep on the plane and woke up basically an infamous internet celebrity. And I think she lost her job and had a whole lot of other negative consequences as a result of that. But that's just kind of my point, is that you can go from, you know, minding your own business and not having a lot of attention on you to being a sort of niche celebrity. And as we all know, you know, celebrities have had to deal with stalkers and other stuff. And that's something that, you know, people in Hollywood are used to, and you know, they have resources and they have infrastructure put in place to help with that. But the average person, not so much.
Yeah, and when it comes to digital bearer assets like Bitcoin, the attack vectors can be even more acute and deliberate. One of the other things Jameson tracks that I think he's the only one that actually keeps an archive of this is physical attacks on Bitcoiners on people that own digital assets. This is often called the $5 wrench attack. I think now with inflation, it's probably more of like a $10 wrench attack. What is that attack, Jameson? And I don't know if you have any prominent examples in your mind, but Jameson tracks this around the world. This happens a relatively decent amount.
Yeah, I mean, basically we're talking about physical coercion for you to hand over your money. You know, it's a traditional robbery. The difference and really what Bitcoin changed is that prior to having digital bearer assets, if someone was going to rob you, they were probably only going to do that if it's a targeted, you know, planned ahead type of home invasion robbery. They're probably only going to do that if they know that you're wealthy and you have like expensive jewelry, precious metals, other things that are small enough to carry off, but really highly dense in value. And so, you know, a pretty limited subset of the population that has those things. And most people who are wealthy, they keep most of their assets in illiquid form, whether that's in various banks and brokerages or, you know, physical real estate. I think there was a really good quote that always stuck with me when someone was talking about why billionaires don't get attacked that often. Someone said, well, it's very hard to steal a baseball team. You know, it's like, you know, what can you get away with from a practical point of view? And so now with these digital bearer assets, someone can easily run off with millions or hundreds of millions of dollars just, you know, on a little thumb drive sized device. And so what's happening is that as this ecosystem continues to grow, people who are criminally minded, which I do think is a fairly small subset of the population, but nevertheless, something to worry about, they are starting to try to calculate what is my ROI if I go target someone who is probably highly wealthy in these digital bearer assets. And so that's what I've been tracking. And there seems to be a pretty strong correlation between, you know, the exchange rates of Bitcoin and other assets to the number of physical attacks that are happening. I don't want to be a fear monger. These are still relatively small numbers. I think maybe 150 attacks that we know about that have been cataloged. There are definitely far more because a lot of people who end up being physically attacked don't publicize it because they don't want to attract even more attention. But some interesting things have come out of this, of like where these attacks are happening. And we actually saw some press recently where I think it's Sweden is having a lot of these attacks. And it's actually, it's being blamed on a Swedish law that requires everyone to publicize their home address. So apparently in Sweden, it's very easy for people to find where you live, and you can't really use the same tools that I've been able to use in the United States to help obfuscate that.
Wow, it's strange and dangerous sounding, putting all your information on the internet like that. I've seen these too. They can be quite frightening, the concept of it. I think it's another reason to, you know, try to maintain a low profile and not, you know, tell the world that, you know, maybe there's 12 or 24 seed words that if they merely got from you, they could take a bunch of your money. Let's transition. I want to ask you, Jameson, you've been in, you said you got interested in Bitcoin in 2012, and you've certainly been working on it for a long time. I see on Twitter you have a Taproot Wizard icon. I know you've been outspoken on a variety of Bitcoin issues over the years, including during the block size wars and 2016 and 17. What is the state in your mind of Bitcoin culture? And I don't want to, like, for our audience, I mean, I think Bitcoin culture is significantly bigger and less homogenous than, you know, the Twitter and X.com sphere would make you think. But I guess in terms of the loudest parts, it seems like we're entering quite an interesting time in Bitcoin culture. Maybe with some forks in the road. I should say lowercase forks in the road about what is the true meaning of Bitcoin, its value proposition. How has it evolved over your years watching Bitcoin, and where do you think it's headed?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a long essay that I think I entitled it A History of Bitcoin Maximalism, in which I talked about what I saw as being the evolution of the predominant Bitcoin culture over the past 10 years. And it has devolved in a sense, but not in an unexpected way. I mean, I think as the ecosystem goes more mainstream, you're going to have larger and larger cohorts of people coming in with less and less deep levels of knowledge. So you have more people coming in with only a very surface level of knowledge, and you know, perhaps they're not devoting the same amount of time that some of us OGs who are really nerdy devoted to it. And so what's happening is that, you know, they are looking to people in positions of leadership or reputation to kind of tell them, you know, what's going on, what should I be thinking about these things that are happening in the community. And so really what I have kind of settled on that I think is happening, at least in the past year or two, is that there seems to be a contingent of, I guess we could call them influencers or outspoken people in the Bitcoin community, who have taken a much more moral stance rather than like technical and economic stance of what they perceive to be like the correct use of Bitcoin and the correct path forward for Bitcoin. And it's really gotten to the point where I felt like just calling people maximalists doesn't really mean much anymore. That term doesn't mean much because there's many different types of maximalists. I believe I was the first one to coin the term Bitcoin monetary maximalist a number of years ago when I got canceled for being involved in a registered securities token. And I explained why I felt like, you know, registered securities tokens were completely fine to be interested in. They're like, they're not trying to be Bitcoin or even be like a, you know, permissionless DeFi type of thing. And so now we have these people who I don't even call them toxic maximalists anymore. I tend to refer to them as Puritans because they tend to take puritanical views on, like, if you do anything outside of these specific use cases, you are unclean and, you know, you are not a good Bitcoiner. And so, you know, I've clashed with many people over the years due to my views on Bitcoin and the greater crypto ecosystem. Like, as you noted, I have a Taproot wizard, and it's not because I'm like into inscriptions and ordinals and whatnot. I mean, I've been paying attention to it. I haven't been like buying and trading these things, but you know, I got offered a Taproot wizard inscription, and I was like, sure, you know, I'll do it just to piss off the Puritans. You know, it's more of a, like a social signaling type of mechanism, and it'll be interesting to see where things go from here. There have been some talks of like forking, but really, I think that's actually the Puritans hoping that the unclean people will fork off of Bitcoin and leave them alone. And I don't think that's going to happen. As much as I would like to see a fork and an airdrop, I don't think that the actual like economic will power is there to pull it off.
It really has. I feel like it really accelerated during COVID when everyone was sort of at home and all there really was Clubhouse and podcasts. You saw a real sort of escalation in the homogeneity of the Bitcoin viewpoint, I think. So I tend to think that any of these disputes and public sort of debates about Bitcoin are ultimately positive. They help, you know, increase the tent size of Bitcoin. And in the end, I mean, I think of Bitcoin as a technical and economic thing. Yeah, I agree. I love your point about that they look at it through more of a moral lens. That's tricky, right? Because morality, everybody has a different view on morality. And it's also so prescriptive as to be narrowing rather than expanding the pie. What's something that gets you extremely excited about Bitcoin, you know, just in the, let's say, over the next year or two?
Well, I want to continue seeing improvements at the protocol level. I like the fact that there have been, it seems, an acceleration in proposals for various protocol improvements. Of course, it's been several years now since our actual last soft fork. And I would say we still haven't really taken advantage of everything that you know, Taproot and TapScript and Schnorr signatures have given to us. There's a lot of tooling that still remains to be built around that. But there's a need for continued improvement to both the security and scalability of the protocol. So, you know, one proposal that I wrote about is OpVault. And I think that's interesting, and that it kind of goes in conjunction with a number of other covenants proposals that have been getting more traction over the past year. And the short version is covenants is basically a way to impose future restrictions on how your Bitcoin can be spent. OpVault is a very specific type of covenant, which I've found interesting because it actually gives you what I've been calling a reactive security. So right now, the only security you have for your coins is proactive. You have to, you know, build up a really, really high wall of defenses, because if any attacker busts through all your defenses, they wipe you out and your money is gone and you can't get it back. Cool thing about vaults is that you can actually construct your, you know, Bitcoin deposit address with additional conditions that say, okay, if the money is going to get spent out of this address, it actually has to go to a temporary holding area for some period of time. And during that period of time, I can yank back the funds. So this actually allows you to get your money back if your proactive security gets busted through, and you basically sweep the funds to a separate, you know, recovery wallet that you have set up ahead of time. There's also, you know, potential scalability improvements that would allow us to further enhance Lightning Network. So while Lightning Network is kind of like a force multiplier in the sense that you can do a theoretically unlimited number of transactions off-chain by only doing two on-chain transactions, even that can be improved further. Where we could essentially have shared Lightning channels. So imagine if you could have 1,000 people sharing a Lightning channel and only two on-chain transactions, and then doing tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of off-chain transactions. So especially with all of the ordinals and inscriptions stuff, putting a lot more contention for the scarce block space, I think that that should make it clear that, you know, we still need further scalability improvements.
Yeah, I would love to see. Casa seems like a prime venue to implement some cool covenant stuff once Vault or CTV or one of these others gets implemented. I would love to see that. I know at Fidelity we were quite interested in vaulted custody in general, the same types of ideas. Spencer Hommel and Sam Abbasi, Bob McElrath all did work on that. Brian Bishop did work on it as well with them, right? I think. So that would be awesome. What would you say, I wanted to ask you about this. Greg Maxwell was once asked on Reddit what the biggest threat to Bitcoin was, and he replied that, no, it wasn't a 51% attack. It wasn't, sure, there's risks of a code bug or something. There's always those risks. But that it was actually sort of ignorance and apathy among the populace. And you mentioned this a little bit. You talked about new people coming in and only knowing a little bit, but in your mind, I don't know, you can either agree or disagree with that specific thing, or maybe there's something totally else. What's the biggest risk to Bitcoin's continued adoption in your mind?
Well, to continued adoption, I think requires ignorance. Just not looking at the state of the world and what's happening, all of the financial shenanigans that people are able to opt out of if they put in the time and effort. But no, apathy, I think, has been the biggest threat, and always will be, because, you know, if you look at any of these systems, even as I catalog like the downfall of some of the scammier systems, it's very, very difficult to kill a truly decentralized system. You know, even some of the ones that I would call dead for most practical purposes, the networks are still running. There's still like a handful of people, you know, running the nodes, and the protocol is technically still operational. So I've said for a while that, you know, Bitcoin can't die unless we all agree that it's dead and we stop working on it and stop maintaining it. This is also why I'm not really worried about a point in time catastrophic attack, like, say, a protocol exploit does get found and is actually used on the live network, or say that there is a 51% nation state attack that essentially prevents transactions from getting confirmed. You know, those things, while they would be critical and they would stop the network from being usable for that point in time, as long as those of us who care are paying attention, even if the machine consensus of the protocol and the network is broken for some reason, we can always fall back to human consensus. And this has happened before several times. It's been 10 years at this point since the last time that happened. We hope that it doesn't happen, but that's always a disaster recovery option It just requires that the technical people are still around and care enough to try to analyze the problem, propose a solution, and move forward.
Yep. I do think that if we ever encountered anything dramatic, Bitcoiners would fix it. Sometimes people say, well, what if quantum computing is one of my favorite FUDs? You know, I don't know. There's a variety of them. What if it could break ECDSA or you know, and steal funds? Or what if, you know, one little quantum computer or big, I don't know, maybe they're big, could like hash the entire, you know, replicate the entire hash rate of the network. And I've always just said, well, I mean, if that happened, I mean, Bitcoiners could just hard fork and fix it. Like, it's not like we don't want a hard fork, but I mean, if it were existential, certainly they'd fix it. We would fix it, right? Well, look, my friend Jameson, I really appreciate you joining us from an undisclosed location, co-founder and CTO of Casa, a great Bitcoin and crypto custody company. Is that what you would say? Custody company? That doesn't sound right. Self-custody company?
Yeah. That's where it gets a little tricky, right? You know, we help people be their own bank. You know, we help you achieve a level of self-sovereignty where, you know, you still have someone that you can come to get advice, and you don't have to kind of go out on your own, do the lone wolf thing. Because really, if you go out and you're setting up your own bank, as it were, without getting any advice and basically having to do all your own research, it's a lot more likely that you may accidentally introduce some flaws, because this isn't what you do for a living. It's what I've done for a living for 9 years now.
Well, Casa is a great resource. Check out Jameson's content at lopp.net, L-O-P-P.net. I do all the time. And again, Jameson Lopp, CTO and co-founder of Casa, thank you so much for coming on Galaxy Brains.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's episode of Galaxy Brains. Thanks to our guest, Jameson Lopp, CTO, co-founder of Casa, a great Bitcoin custody and security company, and our good friend, Bimnetta BB from Galaxy Trading, as always. Everyone have a safe and warm and happy weekend, and we will catch you next week. Thanks for listening to Galaxy Brains, the weekly podcast from Galaxy Research. If you enjoy the show, please like, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. To follow Galaxy Research, sign up for our weekly newsletter at gdr.email, read our content at galaxy.com/research, and follow us on Twitter at GLXY Research. See you next week.